United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is a document Alaska Natives and American Indians have been pushing the U.S. to endorse for years. President Obama did just that in December. The signing on by the U.S. has been hailed as long overdue recognition of the rights of Indigenous people worldwide, but the U.S. has attempted to limit its support in certain areas. How does this affect implementation of the declaration? What policy implications could the document contain for Native people? We'll discuss it today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message sponsored by the Native American Trust. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello and welcome to Talk of Alaska this morning. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in again for Steve Heimel. And today we're talking about the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I have to correct myself because I misstated that a moment ago. And I have guests to help sort of flesh out this conversation a bit about what this document means for tribes and what the potential policy implications are. Joining me today is Andrea Carmen, who is the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. And good morning.
Good Andrea. Morning.
Thank you for being here. Also in the studio is Chief Gary Harrison of the Chickaloon Tribe. Good morning, Chief Harrison.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. And Liz Medicine Crow with First Alaskans Institute. Hi, Liz.
Good morning.
Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. This is really exciting. And this is a big issue, and the 144 nations signed on to this declaration in 2007, but the U.S., New Zealand, Australia, and Canada did not. That finally happened in 2010. Did all four nations sign on in 2010, or did the U.S. and then the other nations follow suit? How did that happen?
The United States was the very last to state support for the declaration. There's not so much a signing on process. The vote was the vote, and they can't change their vote. But Australia was the first of the four, and then New Zealand, then Canada, and United States was in the trail, the trailer country. So there was a significant celebration when that happened. At the same time, there was a lot of concern about the attempts by the United Nations or the United States to water down the declaration in their own statement of support, and that's being challenged by Indigenous peoples and not only in the United States, tribes in the United States, but around the world. You can't rewrite an existing international declaration. So we're standing on the original language and not the U.S. qualifications.
Well, let's get into a little bit about what those attempted qualifications are by the U.S., but I want to invite people to call in also, 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK if you're out of the Anchorage area. If you're in the Anchorage area, the number is 550-8422. That's the local number. So the U.S. decided to sign the declaration, but they wanted some caveats in there. What kind of limitations did they place, or did they attempt to place?
Well, one of the major ones was one that we fought about a lot during the drafting of the document, and that is the S on peoples. And that what they're trying to say is that the S on peoples doesn't give us the rights of autonomy. And we agree that it doesn't give us the rights of autonomy. Many of us have those rights without, all it's doing is recognizing those rights. And they don't want this document to recognize certain rights, and that's one of the major rights that they don't want to recognize. And many of us say, well, we understand this document isn't a limiting document. It's supposed to be the basis for our rights, not the ceiling. And there's a lot of people that argue that it's the ceiling. And I disagree, being that I was part of the people there arguing about this document with the different governments, which they call states. And the reason that we were there was to try and make it the best document we could make. We knew eventually we weren't the ones who were going to have to agree on this document, but we definitely wanted it to recognize our rights to the fullest extent we could make it.
And so what, when the U.S. argued against the S on peoples and some of the other things that they attempted to limit, what was their reasoning behind that? What did they have a stated, did they give a presentation of why they felt like they had to put these limits in place?
Well, it was interesting for some of us who were there throughout the entire process. And my organization, the International Indian Treaty Council, IITC, was actually the first indigenous organization to get consultative status with the United Nations all the way back in 1977. And we were there from the very beginning of the process when indigenous peoples recognized that the existing rights under international law either didn't completely cover the concerns that we had for the violation of our human rights, or were not being applied to indigenous peoples because we weren't being recognized as peoples, as Gary said. The right to self-determination is a sweeping, broad right recognized for all peoples in the International Human Rights Covenants, one of which the United States has ratified through a treaty ratification process. But yet, that's why they didn't want to say we were peoples, because they'd already agreed under international law that all peoples have the right to self-determination without qualification. So in the drafting process, as Gary referred to, they attempted to insert qualifying language on self-determination for indigenous peoples, another qualification they came out with December 16th, 2010, was that the right to free, prior, and informed consent, which permeates the UN Declaration, as well as other pronouncements of international bodies for indigenous peoples, was really a right to consultation, which is a meeting. That's not a right. Consent is the right to say yes or no, and the Declaration refers to that right when it comes to development, legislative and administrative actions, use of hazardous materials, right to maintain your cultural property and access to sacred sites. It permeates the document, but they want to rewrite that in their qualifications. And the fact of the matter is they tried through the drafting process to insert that kind of language to weaken the text, and they didn't prevail. They weren't able to do that. In the end, the document that was adopted by the General Assembly has the broad recognition of rights like free, prior, and informed consent and self-determination.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or locally 550-8422. To join our discussion today, we're talking about the U.S. signing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And Liz, some of this conversation obviously is going to be contentious with certain groups of people when they talk about implementation and the right to self-determination, the right to have influence over development or a say in what's happening on traditional and native lands. And your work at First Alaskans has been dealing a lot with trying to have respectful dialogue between organizations and groups of people who maybe have a hard time coming to the table. I know that you're working on a Kellogg Foundation grant that helps develop some of these methods. I'm trying to tie these two together, because I know that some of this is going to be tough to sit down and discuss at the table and have people take in. What have you been working on that kind of crosses this area? I imagine you haven't had any talks with groups yet about this declaration, but certainly similar conversations about land rights and about the right to self-determination and respect for culture, those sorts of things.
In fact, that's the premise upon which we built our Kellogg proposal, and that was that the First People of Alaska would host and gather the people of Alaska to a discussion about what racial equity really means, to work to continue to eliminate racism within Alaska by using respectful dialogue built on the foundation of Indigenous principles of engagement. And the idea is that we offer people an opportunity to really get down to what it is that divides us in a way that allows us to speak to each other candidly as opposed to just adversarially. This is a process that's in is in development, and our project lasts for 2 years. Now, I've been thinking about this question you posed to me, Lori, about how does the declaration and the work that we have to do in the Policy Center with the Kellogg Project come together. And for me, it's really about understanding that the First People must be a part of the conversation. We were left out of it from the beginning. And by being able to host these conversations and actually have people understand that the Indigenous people of Alaska are important to the success of Alaska overall, is critical to the overall success of the project. And so what I see in the declaration affirms many of those same principles. So I'm excited to see the direction that this goes. I'm excited to see the direction that our Native people across this country are going to take this. I know that there are many discussions happening now about how do you actually use this as a point of policy to influence and advocate on behalf of your peoples.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, you know, where are the teeth in this declaration? It's very lengthy and lays out a lot of articles. And I know that Chief Harrison at Chicoloon, it's my understanding that you're hoping to use this or you are using this to kind of work against this proposal for a mine. Is that correct?
Well, it's one of the tools that we're going to try and use on this. One of the things in it that is the prior informed consent. And one of the things that hasn't happened here. And when they talk about consultation, that's not, as mentioned earlier, that is not the same thing as free, prior, and informed consent. Consultation means that we go and talk to them and they say, well, okay, we heard what you're saying, but that's not really what we're going to do in most cases is what happens. And I haven't seen any yet so far that they say, oh, yeah, we're going to do that. And mainly because they feel that we're domestic sovereigns, which is an oxymoron. And, you know, I don't know how they can modify that. You're either sovereign or you're not. You're born with sovereignty. Someone may try and suppress your sovereignty, which is what's being done here, but you don't lose it. You can't give it away, you know. So it's really an interesting thing on what the United States and some of the other governments are really trying to do with the word sovereignty and the rights that go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Andrea?
That brings up another qualification that many have pointed out in the United States State Department written statement that followed President Obama's announcement. And that's that all of the rights in the declaration will be interpreted in accordance with existing federal law. And this was another argument that not just the United States, but many of the countries put forth, is that they would need to interpret anything that came out in the declaration in terms of or under their understanding for federal law. And our position was that you can't insert that in international law. That goes against the principle of having international standards. There's 192 countries at the United Nations, each with their own federal law. And we already have that, and we wouldn't be at the United Nations if that was acceptable. So this is an aspirational document. We don't think that that means it doesn't have teeth. What it means is each state that endorses it, which now includes the United States, needs to examine their federal law in terms of the rights laid out in the Declaration and bring up any principles and laws that don't coincide with what they've agreed to, which, by the way, says in its text is the minimum standard. It's the floor. It's not the ceiling. Many people that feel it didn't go far enough, and in some aspects it probably didn't, because it had to be adopted by the United Nations, by the countries itself. But it is a floor to stand on that we didn't have before, that's been recognized internationally, and we can take it up higher if we can do that in our negotiations for implementation.
When the United States signed the document, did they present one with sort of like red markings and lines through certain texts and things like that, or did they sign the document as it exists?
Well, I haven't seen any signature. There's not really a sign-on page. There was a vote in 2007, and the U.S. voted against, and that will be the historical record forever. But Obama's words, the president's words, were the United States has decided to lend its support. And they had a whole year of a review process, both internal in government agencies and external. And they received, they said, more than 3,000 letters from not just tribes and indigenous organizations, but from other, Amnesty International, ACLU, a large number of non-indigenous human rights organizations, Social Responsible Investors Network. They all wrote that this was a bottom line human rights demand of the global human rights community. And I think that really had a big effect on the administration. In terms of their statement of support. But so far, the words we have are the United States will lend its support. Mm-hmm. That's it right now. So in terms of anyone's signature or red markings or anything like that, we haven't seen anything like that. We're kind of waiting because implementation is the bottom line, mm-hmm. and that's what's going to count.
1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is the number statewide, or locally 550-8422. We're talking about the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the U.S. Lending its support as of December. And I want to talk just a bit about what teeth this may have. But Liz, was there something you wanted to add there?
Well, I just actually wanted to ask a question. As I was preparing for this, I was looking through some of the older news releases and articles that had been printed. And one of them, the Washington Times article that I read, talked a little bit about what to expect coming out of the State Department. And I was wondering, is there any newer information than the signing or the support, lending of support of from the State Department, aside from that it will be examined under current and existing federal law. Have you guys heard of anything else that the State Department might be working on? The article made it seem as if they were doing a review and would be coming out with recommendations on how this kind of declaration might be implemented in the U.S.
I think most of the action is coming from the side of indigenous peoples and tribal governments, tribal leadership. There is a lot of discussion going on. I just came back from a meeting of California Indian tribal leaders that were talking about implementation. And one Indian nation, Pitt River Nation, is an affiliate on our board of directors, and they're using the declaration in several articles in their negotiations with the BLM and the Forest Service to protect their sacred site, Medicine Lake, from geothermal development. And other Indian nations are using it in other ways, for instance, in the Southwest, to assert consent or refusal to give consent, I should say, over renewed uranium mining in sacred sites areas that is proposed by the U.S. federal government. So as the process for 30 years at the United Nations really was from the indigenous peoples insisting on full participation in the development of the declaration, insisting on language that could not be minimized. You know, there were definitely bottom lines like the S on peoples, like consent instead of consultation, like unqualified right to self-determination in the text. I think that's going to be like that now, where we just have to inform our tribal leadership and our grassroots communities about what it actually says, and that is the minimum standard, as the text says, and that's how they're going to go into any negotiations with the federal government. And I think that's how it will end up getting implemented.
Well, in talking about how you gave some good examples of how people are using the document, the declaration, to resist any kind of development that they don't desire on areas of sacred sites or other of their traditional lands. Have you seen someone take it as far as using it in court yet? I know that there was a case of one of the UN declarations on the rights to water, water and sanitation for indigenous people worldwide, or all people. I guess it's actually a right to water for all people. That declaration has been used in court by a tribe in Africa to resist against a government standard that wasn't allowing them access to a certain water. And a judge used that declaration as part of his decision in putting an injunction in against it. So there is a little bit of legal precedent, but I'm wondering if there's any that you've seen in the years that it's been implemented in other parts of the world. Have people actually taken this declaration into court and had success with it that way?
Well, the Supreme Court of Belize, the country Belize, in South America or Central America, actually referred to the declaration. This was even before it was adopted. And the courts in Kenya also did the same before it was actually adopted by the General Assembly, because it was adopted by the UN Human Rights Council before that. And they were able to use that to actually successfully argue the indigenous peoples and their attorneys for land rights in those two countries. We've also seen different countries implement it as federal law and change their policies. Bolivia has actually adopted the whole declaration now as federal law. Japan, right after the signing, and they were one of the countries that voted in favor, changed their land rights policy for the indigenous peoples, the Ainu peoples, and they came out and said, well, now they've endorsed the declaration, they need to follow suit and change their federal laws. And we're hoping that also happens here in the United States. There's definitely federal laws, including those being applied here in Alaska, that need to be brought up to the minimum standard recognizing inherent rights of indigenous peoples that are contained in the declaration. So we're waiting for that to happen, but I know there are some current court cases in the lower 48 that attorneys, tribal attorneys, are beginning to cite the UN Declaration in the cases, and we're looking at, you know, those things to make a difference. Speaking of right to water, I think, you know, now would be a good time to mention a filing that's going to go in today, and Gary can say more about that, I think.
We have a scoop on Talk of Alaska.
We have definitely a scoop, and we'll put out a press release. I think Chickaloon's going to do that later in the day.
Well, we're filing with the United Nations independent expert on the human right to water and sanitation. They're having meetings on this, and we're going to put out a document before they have one in Sacramento on that. And we'll be down there discussing this with her as well.
And this is in relation to the Wishbone Hill coal mine effort?
Yes. Part of the reason is a lot of people don't know it, but water is sacred to us, and so is the air. It's so sacred that we have clans named after it. And, you know, it's not right to pollute these things. You know, that's how we feel about it. And what they're doing to this water, or going to be doing to this water with their toxic waste, and what they're going to be doing releasing into the air, is problematic to us. And we feel that they shouldn't be doing this, because it's not right to pollute, you know, our sacred things. And water and air are sacred things to us. Not to mention what it's going to do to the whole ecology there. I mean, it's going to ruin a whole ecosystem right there. And a lot of people don't understand what ecosystem means. There's large ones and there's smaller ones. This is a smaller ecosystem. But you start ruining all the small ecosystems, and that's what make up the larger ecosystems, and you don't have one anymore. And that's part of the problem. There's no place anymore for them to say, well, we can go over there and get clean drinking water. I mean, if you look around, almost every place you look, there's a mine somewhere. All up and down Matanuska, there's been mining. There's still gold mining in some of the tributaries. You go over across the inlet where it's supposed to be pristine and everything. They want to do another coal mine there, wipe out 11 streams, salmon streams. Where's it going to end? Where is people going to start putting down their foot and saying, this is enough? We have to eat. We can't eat coal.
And Chief Harrison, I want to ask this next question of you. We had an email into the show from Mindy in Anchorage. And since we're in Athabascan territory here, I think this would be an appropriate question to ask you. She's asking, what is an indigenous group? How long do they have to live in a location before they become indigenous people? Do they lose their rights if they move from their original location? We are all indigenous to somewhere, and we should all have rights to self-determination. So explain so that people can understand what is meant by indigenous peoples.
Well, she's right. We're all indigenous to somewhere. But your rights basically come from basically where you're indigenous from. We happen to be indigenous from here, and having other people come from other places to displace our rights here is not right. And I think that what they're trying to get at is a little different question, like, okay, we have rights too, but your rights don't trump our rights, and our rights don't trump yours. But our rights are here. Our rights are here with the land. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. And because they have rights doesn't mean they have the right to come in and take our land, our resources, pollute them, and leave us destitute with no food.
We're going to take a call now, and this looks like this might be along these same lines. This is Anne in Homer, who has a comment about native sovereignty. Anne, are you there?
Yes, thank you. This is a word that I've heard for many years, but I've never really understood what people mean when they talk about native sovereignty, what it means in a practical sense. For example, right now we're all subject to criminal and civil legal system of Alaska, and if there is, say, a crime between a native and a non-native person, or a native and a non-native person want to sign a contract with each other to do something, it's all subject to Alaska state law and court system, not treated as an international incident. And how does native sovereignty change this, or does it change it? How does it mean that all 200 villages have their entirely own legal systems, and that they're not subject to Alaska laws, and Alaskans aren't subject to their laws, and it's an international incident every time two people have some kind of legal connection to each other?
Who wants to take a stab at that?
Well, that may be right, only I can tell you that as far as human rights go, nobody has a right to take away another person's right. And yeah, that might be that we all have our different legal system in each one of our villages, but that's our right. And the rights that have been taken from us and the value system that has been put on us has put many of us in jail at a far higher increasing rate than any other social group of people in Alaska and in the United States. And I think that there's something wrong with the legal system that's here when they can do that. Because I happen to know a lot of these people myself, and I know that what's going on, they're not all raising bad people. But that's the way it's all happening because of the way the legal system is put out there. And all the statistics show that the indigenous people here get longer sentences than any other ones. and a lot of the things that happen to them in these jails when they've just been put in for a minor infraction and they end up having to defend themselves, they end up getting longer and longer sentences. And it makes criminals out of people who are put in there for small infractions. And I don't think that's right. Other people may disagree with me on this, but I still don't think it's right when a system is put in place that targets a specific group of people. And that's what's happened here.
We're going to continue this conversation and talk.
Can I ask a follow-up to that?
Very quickly.
Yeah. Do you think that Native people would be better off if, for example, and this happens all too often, a non-Native man sexually assaults a Native woman in one of our cities, and that woman is treated as a foreigner who is not, and the Native people, the village where she comes from doesn't have jurisdiction over the perpetrator of the crime?
I'm not clear what your question is, Anne.
I'm saying if the 200 villages are all sovereign countries, then Native people become foreigners when they're outside of their village and they don't have the rights of protection that Alaskans have, and the abilities to have, when a crime is committed against them, to have the protection that American citizens would have. It seems to me people would be worse off with this way.
All right, well, thank you for that.
The villages don't have the resources to enforce the law against non-Native perpetrators of crime.
Thank you for that question. We'll take an answer from Andrea very quickly, and then we've got to take a short break.
The UN Declaration affirms rights to land and territories that indigenous peoples traditionally used, owned, and occupied. And it would be hard to find a place in Alaska that didn't apply to that particular definition in terms of rights and relations. The fact is, though, that we do now live with many people that came from somewhere else and have settled on our territories, not just here, but where I'm from in Arizona and all over. And we have to find a way to live in harmony and peace. The Declaration preamble says that the recognition of the rights in the Declaration will be the basis of harmonious and cooperative relations. And the fact is that rights have been denied for Indigenous peoples, and there needs to be a new relationship between Indigenous nations and settler governments and settlers from elsewhere based on mutual recognition and mutual respect and fundamental respect of the rights of the first peoples of the land.
When we come back from a short break, I think that this is a great opportunity to sort of flesh out some of the work that you're doing, Liz. And when we get to these points where the conversation starts to get a little contentious because people wonder, what does this mean, and how will my rights be affected? Mm-hmm. We're talking about the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples today. And we have guests in the studio that are talking about what this means now that the U.S. has endorsed the document, although they're attempting to endorse it with some limitations, but we'll talk about that as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com, and by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Welcome back. You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Our number to call if you'd like to join our conversation today is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. That's the statewide number, 550-8422. 550-8422 is the local number. And we're going to take, well, we have another call from Homer. So we'll take a call now from Lisa in Homer. And you want to talk about Native people and mining?
No, I actually had a question. I think I'm probably in a majority that thinks that sovereignty for First Nations people everywhere is a great idea, because it's probably the environmental legislation that we can't seem to pass in our own country for protection of the environment. My question is really, so as I understand it, sovereignty will allow that that free decision to do what you will with your own land. And while it seems on the surface, it would be always to protect the air and the land and the water. And as one of your guests spoke earlier about, you know, the protection of ecosystems, my question is, what happens if somewhere down the road, people of the First Nations decide to, for example, start their own uranium mine? It's just a sort of a topic of conversation. I'm just curious. I can't imagine that happening. And how does this document work, I guess, in relation to, for example, our own EPA legislation?
Well, that is an interesting question. Thank you, Lisa, for that, because we have seen incidents in the past where certain tribal governments have corrupt members that get into a place of power. That's happened in the lower 48 in a few cases that I know I reported on, where people had to sort of, you know, lock the council out of the tribal offices in order to take back what they felt was an appropriate way of governing their territories, to kind of stave off the threat of mining or uranium dumps, depleted uranium. How do you see this? What are the protections in place to make sure that this always keeps Indigenous people's best interests in mind?
If I could,
Liz.
One of the things that I find to be highly valuable to me as an Indigenous person when I read this United Nations Declaration is that there's an emphasis on self-determination, on self-governance, and on the right to make decisions about how your land will be developed. To me, that stands in great alignment with the things that my grandparents spoke to me about as I grew up, about our rights, about our responsibilities and our obligations as tribal people of our land to take care of it, to help the people come to decisions in discussions. I mean, this whole idea about free, prior, and informed consent is really about allowing people to make decisions that are not coerced, to make decisions that are informed with the best information possible, that it happens before something happens instead of afterwards when it's too late. And that consent means a voice in the decision-making process, the ability to say yes or no, the ability to decide whether this is something that you're going to go forward with or not. You know, it might be difficult for many people to think about that in relationship to Indigenous peoples and how we move forward, but just think about it in terms of your own individual self in relationship to when you go and talk to your doctor and you have some healthcare issues. The standard of care that the doctor gives you is one based on free, prior, and informed consent. And this is the same kind of thing, that the people who are affected have the right to be able to make those determinations. And when it comes to environmental issues, when it comes to justice issues, when it comes to education issues, those are things that Indigenous people have for a long period of time struggled with in order to get others to understand that these things, in terms of their self-determination and their self-governance capacities, are inherent to a people. They are not something that are given. these things come with the fact that you are born of this land, that you are part of it. And I think that that is something that my grandparents imparted to me long ago that I see reflected in the Declaration.
Is there concern about, I've heard some folks here in Alaska talk about concern in the future over the leadership of the Native corporations, for example, that at some point in time there could be more of a corporate mindset and a more of a focus on making a profit rather than being mindful and connected to the idea of sustaining homelands and place and making sure that in, you know, subsequent generations that things are still available to people for subsistence and that sort of thing. And I wonder if maybe that's part of what Lisa was trying to get at, is how do you protect to make sure that these good tenants stay in place into the future?
Well, the Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples addresses rights of peoples, not corporations. And it's important to distinguish those two without, you know, getting into a discussion of ANCSA and, you know, who is for it and who's against it and how it was created in the first place. Corporations are state or federally licensed entities. They are not governments and they are not peoples. It's important, I think, when you have a discussion of development to understand the Declaration supports the right of Indigenous peoples to define their own development and development under international laws, not just economic development or mining or timber cutting. It actually is defined as, under the right of self-determination, as economic, social, and cultural development, and the right to define for yourself what that is. Just to give one example from Alaska, the Gwich'in peoples, Vinatai and Arctic Village, are member affiliates. In fact, they sit on our board of directors, and they've explained to us that for them, development is based on protecting the caribou. Their spiritual, cultural, economic, and social development is based on caribou, not on oil. So that's how they've defined their development, and that's what they're committed to protect.
1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation. We're going to take a call from Jeff in Anchorage, and he has a comment about sovereignty.
Hello. Hi, Lori. Hi, Liz. This is Jeff. I wanted to go back to, it's not unrelated either, to the previous caller's comment about sovereignty and confusion, and just point out that I think the special status of Native Americans with the federal government and their place in history, I think is profoundly misunderstood, and I don't think it's been explained well to anyone. And so it's confusing to the caller to say sovereignty on one hand and citizen of Alaska and the United States on the other.
I think you're right. I think that is difficult for people to fully understand. Liz, do you want to try and make some additional comment about...
Yeah, Jeff, I think you're right on. And in fact, that's what I was thinking when I think her name was Anne called from Homer, and really seeking to understand what sovereignty means, what that impact is on Alaska Native peoples here within this state. And I think that these are very complicated legal terms for many people. And yet sovereignty is something that I think everybody understands, and that's essentially the combination of freedom and liberty and self-determination, the ability to, you know, to decide for your own people what is best for your own people. And those things preexisted the formation of the United States. They preexisted the formation of the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution itself recognizes the Indian people of the United States and creates a distinctly political relationship outside of the context of race and minority status. And so as Indian people, as Indigenous people, as Alaska Native people, we have a relationship through our tribes with the federal government that is unique and special for this country. And it is both one that is recognized and one that has responsibilities on both the part of the federal government and the part of the Indian people. Our tribes are self-governing. Our tribes have the right to determine for themselves who their citizens are, their members are. They have jurisdiction over those citizens and members. And it gets a little dicey when you start talking about, you know, jurisdiction here in Alaska, because everything is so complicated to the 10th power for Alaska Native people.
And it does come to a head in questions of justice and taxation and protecting the environment. It comes to a head, and I think it's incumbent upon you and people who understand what sovereignty means and the special relationship that Indigenous people have with the government to educate people, so when it comes to head again, people come to the table with an understanding and can move forward, rather than becoming a hot button either racial or other issue.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call and trying to help us help other people kind of clarify what this means, because I know it is difficult for people to understand the overlying jurisdictional areas and how that all works together. Chief Harrison?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny that they are wondering how bad we can mismanage things. And really, if you take a look at what's going on, the reason these questions even come up is because of how badly the dominant government right now is mismanaging things. And I think that if we had another government, no matter what government it is, mismanage things the way this one is, we'd have to fight against it as well. So because you have the rights of self-determination doesn't mean that you're going to have to give up your vigil to keep everything right the way it's supposed to be. Humans are humans, and there's good humans and there's bad humans in every race. Unfortunately, in the government that we're under, most of the humans that are running it aren't thinking like the rest of us are as human as they are. And one of the ways they do it is by dehumanizing many of us, which is why we're here on the rights of Indigenous peoples in the first place, is because these governments have dehumanized us in the first place. And I just wanted to also make a comment about the sexual assault. The lady has no idea about what happens to the victims in this state because they don't have many rights. And if they do, if they're Native, many times these rights are not upheld. Otherwise, you wouldn't be finding all of these dead women in the springtime with really not much happening by the government.
1-800-478-8255 is the statewide number. 550-8422 is the local number to join our conversation. We're going to go to Tom in Metlakatla, and Tom has a question about ANCSA, which I'm kind of glad he's bringing that into the conversation, because I wanted to ask, too, about how this may kind of come together. Or does it? Does this declaration impact or have potential impact for some of ANCSA? Tom, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
And what was your question?
Well, yeah, on your opening statement, the gentleman that said that, I think he said that you couldn't give or sell or have your Indigenous inherent rights taken away. But my question is similar to, brings to mind of Esau in the Bible. Didn't the 13 regions, Alaska Natives, sell their rights in the Alaska Native Land Claims Act? That act is now a law of the land, and in that act it says that they gave up those rights. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of the Simpsons down here on the reservation, we didn't join the land claims, but almost, even the people probably sitting in your studio there are land claims people, and thousands and thousands and thousands of Alaskans are Native land claims people in almost every village. How does this declaration of the UN, how does it refer to these land claims people that are that supposedly have given up these claims? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, thank you, Tom. That's a good question for the group here to ponder. Chief Harrison, you look like you've got an answer.
First of all, we never gave up anything. This was a law that was foisted upon us by the federal government, and we didn't. I didn't vote on it. Most of the people that I know of never voted on it. And even the straw poll that they took prior, not all the people voted for it. So when you say our rights were given up, they weren't given up. We've never given up our rights, and that is one of the problems is as many people think that we gave up our rights for these corporations. When it's a unilateral act, we didn't pass this act, and we didn't vote and say yes or no. And I haven't given up any of my rights because someone has foisted a corporation upon me.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. We're talking today about the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the fact that the U.S. has supported the document now. And we're going to be taking your calls. The lines are heating up a bit. We'll be taking your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and we're talking today on the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We're going to take another caller from Barrow now. Roy in Barrow has a North Sea example. Roy?
Hey, good morning. Good morning from the top of the world. And this is a very important discussion that needs to be squared away, especially in our country where we see the federal government leasing land or the ocean and the state government. Really, what drove the Native Claim Settlement Act was the oil around Turtle Bay, and they kind of stole that one away from us. We're the only region that voted no against SAFSA, but then somehow, having said no, then we had to follow what the rest of the states follow. And in that in itself, when you have different tribes voting on behalf of us, that's a question. And I think internationally, you don't allow Spain or somebody else vote for the Italians for that matter. But anyway, we've got so many issues that the Treasury and where the federal government needs to be on top of them, help the Native people with the tribal rights, and to somehow the tribal people need to have a consent on what's happening within the ocean and within our lands. And then with the regional corporations, when they were created through ANSA, really, the regional corporations currently, maybe 80% all over the state are employed and are non-shareholders and mostly in Anchorage and the urban areas. And really, when you look at it, when the corporations were created, it's an advantage as an economic base. We see that for the state, but then for the employment size, side of it, a lot of our Native people and the shareholders don't hold those jobs. It was high. Paying jobs are held by non-shareholders. And the decisions on the ocean and on our land that is being made somehow, we're not, our people are not involved in it, and we need to get that squared away, because somehow the state borough, municipality, the North Slope Borough, who's doing a good job in trying to manage it from a statewide perspective, and then through the regional corporations are making profits off the oil companies, which is we see is right. But then when they start deciding on who said yes to our leasing the ocean and who said yes to dividing up the lands, and when we see our corporate land or the lands that we use and they're being leased out to foreign countries, for crying out loud, countryside of Italy, countryside of Canada, are leasing our land. First they take it away, and then they lease it out to foreign countries. It's something that's mind-boggling, and these are issues that we need to straighten out. And that when you try to deal with the federal government, and then we see every day in the news how the corporations are telling the federal government or doing what they need to do and lobby. And
well, let's get at some of these questions. Thank you, Roy, for those comments. And Liz, you had mentioned that AFN has been also examining how this declaration may be implemented. And Roy brought up some interesting thoughts about consent when it comes to offshore leasing and land rights. And I think a lot of that is still unclear, at least in my mind, it's unclear about how this declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples may be applied to some of these other larger policy and legal decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm like you, Lori. I still want to see a lot more information. I still am trying to understand, because of our unique situation here in Alaska, trying to understand more of the complex legal issues around how it could be implemented, how it could be used. I'm excited to see the innovation that the First People across the country will bring to how this can be helpful in lifting our people up. I think it's no common or it's common knowledge that Alaska Native people and Indigenous people, no matter where they reside, are generally not doing as well socially, economically. And as we try to find solutions, what we are talking about is self-determination and self-governance, the actual activity of being the people who are talking about how we create solutions to address those issues is really crucial. And that's, I think, where our leadership is right now, trying to figure out how can we use this tool to help our people move forward.
Well, I hate the fact that we're out of time, but we are running out of time. And it seems to me that this is a discussion that we can take up again in the future as we see how things kind of unfold and how this declaration begins to be applied in policy settings and in legal settings, perhaps in the Chicoloon tribe's fight with this mining initiative. I want to thank my guests, Liz Medicine Crow of First Alaskans Foundation, Chief Gary Harrison of the Chicoloon Tribe, and Andrea Carmen, who is the Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council. I'm Lori Townsend. Steve Heimel will be back next week. Thanks to Dave Waldron and on the phones, Jersey Shedlock and Josh Tucker.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
As Indian Trust land, IIM account, Indian Trust agun, account, $3.4 billion settlement. Website amun IndianTrust.com amun BU Mountain, Hualtoklorlugu, 1-800-961-6109.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.